From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!, live from the Independent Media Center in Philadelphia, breaking with convention, power, protest, and the presidency. Today on the program, Ralph Nader punctures some Republican balloons with a surprise appearance at the Republican convention. Republican Governor George Ryan talks with Nader about his candidacy and the death penalty. Police step up their crackdown on activists in the streets, and a look at health care, seniors, and the drug industry. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from Philadelphia, where the Republican National Convention is in its fourth day. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
And some of the headlines today. Making a mid-convention pivot from unity to campaign warfare, the Republicans ramped up their anti-Clinton rhetoric last night as the 2,000 party delegates nominated George W. Bush to the nation's highest office. Vice presidential candidate Dick Cheney closed out the evening at the First Union Center with an acceptance speech that rebuked the Clinton and Gore administration time and again. Cheney said, on the first hour of the first day, he, George W. Bush, will restore decency and integrity to the Oval Office.
And President Clinton postponed yesterday the first federal execution in 37 years so the condemned man can apply for presidential clemency under brand new guidelines. In a two-page order, Clinton issued a temporary reprieve for convicted drug smuggler and murderer Juan Raul Garza, postponing his scheduled execution from August 5th until December 12th. Under the guidelines, a death row prisoner will receive at least 120 days' notice of the date of execution. Once notified, the prisoner has 30 days to fill a request for clemency. All papers in support of the request must be filed no later than 15 days after the petition has been submitted.
And from Colombia, using U.S.-donated helicopters to reinforce Colombian police during guerrilla attacks will escalate this country's prolonged civil war and draw America closer to direct involvement in the fighting, a spokesman for one of Colombia's rebel groups warned this week. Raul Reyes, spokesman for the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, said that helicopters used to rescue police during attacks will be considered military targets subject to being shot down.
And this news from Indonesia, prosecutors today have charged the former dictator Suharto with siphoning off more than $570 million in state funds and plan to take him to court within days. Suharto is accused of using charities under his control to siphon off the money during his 32-year reign. Suharto was forced to quit after students and workers took to the streets in May of 1998, has denied any wrongdoing. He has yet to been held responsible or tried for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Timorese and Indonesians since he came to power in 1965.
A group representing freelance writers, which is seeking to establish the legitimacy of a central clearinghouse through which writers can be paid for the resale of old articles, is close to signing an agreement that would give new stature and visibility to the clearinghouse. Jonathan Tessini, president of the National Writers Union, and Stephen D. Brill, chief executive of Contentville, a new online content distributor, both said yesterday that they had reached an agreement. It is now subject to approval of the union's executive board. A federal appellate court decision last September in a case brought by Mr. Tessini, the National Writers Union, struck down the contention by several publishers, including the New York Times, Newsday, and Times, that electronic databases and archives were analogous to collected works.
Al Gore has narrowed his search for a running mate to five members of Congress and a female governor. A Democratic source familiar with the vice president's thinking said late last night the closely guarded list consists only of Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana, Senator John Edwards of North Carolina, House Minority Leader Richard Gephardt of Missouri, Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts, Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut, and also Governor Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire.
4 years after it led the nation into a deregulation of the electric industry, California is at the brink of a breakdown in its power supply. The nation's most populous state nearly ran out of power for the third consecutive day this week.
And this news from San Francisco. One man complained he was forced to endure racial epithets. Another said he was ordered to do strenuous jobs despite his disabilities. A third had to work during a federal holiday. 17 black former employees at a Wonder Bread plant were awarded $120 million in punitive damages yesterday in a racial discrimination lawsuit against the nation's largest wholesale baker. Interstate Bakeries Corp., the Kansas City-based company that produces Wonder Bread, Twinkies, Home Pride, and Hostess Cupcakes, said it would appeal the award. The verdict came 2 days after the same jury found that all 21 employees in the suit were subjected to working conditions inferior to those of their white counterparts.
Trade that's free is what it's supposed to be. Not slavery in sweatshops and prisons, factories, poison the water, land and trees, are sold to the slaughter. Corporate greed is trampling human need. Food and sea, twisted for profit. We've sold the part that once was the heart of local economy, industry.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from downtown Philadelphia, Center City, and the Independent Media Center, where we have been broadcasting all week as we move into the fourth day of the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, history was made last night at the Republican Convention, and we're not talking about Dick Cheney's speech. It was what happened on the convention floor while he spoke. And what's believed to be the first time in U.S. history, a candidate for president held an impromptu but well-attended press briefing on the convention floor of an opposing party. We're talking about Ralph Nader. In fact, we'd asked him to come to the convention. We wanted him to provide commentary and analysis. The networks think nothing of bringing in opposition Democrats, but these political figures still invariably reinforce the official line. We brought in Ralph Nader as the voice of an outsider who's been excluded from the political process in many ways. But from the moment we arrived, scores of board reporters desperate for a story, as well as delegates and politicians, swarmed around Ralph Nader, the Green Party presidential candidate and well-known consumer advocate, as we began our journey to the convention floor.
Are you running for office here, Ralph Nader?
How are you doing?
Paul Greenberg is my name from Arkansas. You're going to campaign in Arkansas? You already have campaigned in Arkansas.
Yeah, I was in Arkansas. I've been in all 50 states.
Good. I hear you're very strong in the West.
Mr. Nader, good luck to you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Happy to hear your message. Most people are going to see on in primetime TV on the network coverage. What do you think? What impression are they going to walk away with from the conventions? Are they going to buy the Republican line, all the diversity and economically and racially?
I think most people look at it as political entertainment, a lot of mutual backslapping, a lot of corporate promotion, a lot of hot air politicians. And that's unfortunate because it leads to cynicism when they see someone like Senator John McCain, who stood for political reform in the primaries, suddenly morph himself into George W. Bush, a man he thought stood directly contrary to his views on campaign finance reform. That's what leads people to be cynical, to drop out, not to vote. And we're trying to bring him back into the political process with a new green political party and our candidacy.
Theo, we're from New Jersey, and you're going to lose big time.
Hey, wait a minute.
Good luck to you, pal.
You wouldn't want that, would you?
We would love it. We would want it with a passion.
What party do you think I represent?
You represent the party of your own twisted ideas, my friend.
I just think the little guy is the one at the disadvantage as far as bringing a lawsuit. The corporate and the large companies do have the advantage of large dollars to fund lawsuits to defeat legitimate claims.
Grobnator, what about George Bush's approach to tort reform?
Well, he is contrary to this delegate, state senator from New York. He wants to make it more difficult and erect more barriers for wrongfully injured Americans to have their full day in court against the companies whose dangerous or defective products harmed them. And I think that's one of the few differences between the Republicans and the Democrats.
What do you hope to accomplish by being here?
Well, I want to observe the thing in action. It's hard to believe when you see it reported. You have to see it to believe it. I mean, this is the most spectacular display of political cash register politics with corporate fat cats in the history of the country. And it's always good to see the state of the art shamelessly paraded on national TV.
What's your message to the delegates here?
My message is to go home and rethink what they're doing to the country when they sell politics to corporate fat cats in return for political favors. And that's what I say to the Democrats as well. Our democracy is being hijacked by large commercial interests against the interests of everyday people. And we've got to have political reform in this country. I'm very sorry to see John McCain, who had millions of supporters standing for political reform, morph himself into George W. Bush today.
Sir, at some stage you're drawing at 7 or 8%. Do you think, would you be the spoiler if this race is close?
You can't spoil a political system that's spoiled to the core. We need a new political reform movement in this country. It's not going to come from the Democratic or Republican parties.
What about the political debates, Ralph Nader? Are you going to be included in them? What are you going to do about that?
Public opinion is burgeoning in favor of a four-way debate with me, Buchanan, Bush, and Gore. I think that's what the American people want. They want more choice. They want exciting debates. They don't want to fall asleep in front of the TV set watching the drab debate the dreary.
Ralph Nader in a historic moment on the floor of the Republican National Convention here in Philadelphia as George Bush was being nominated to be the Republican presidential nominee. Just afterwards, Dick Cheney spoke and Ralph Nader came out again and sat with delegates and alternates as people came up to him and asked them to sign their delegate badges. And one woman said her brother was going to be voting for Ralph Nader, and she liked a lot what he had to say.
Well, Nader is a candidate that doesn't need a big publicity machine because he's already well known for his record in the country by people of all political persuasions.
That's right, Juan. Well, as we left the Republican National Convention, we headed over to the press tents where Nader made his way through the rounds of TV and radio shows. And as he was being interviewed on NBC, we bumped into Illinois Governor George Ryan, who'd just been interviewed on ABC.com. George Ryan is an interesting governor from Illinois, conservative Republican, who imposed a moratorium on the death penalty in Illinois a few months ago after more than a dozen people on death row were proved to be innocent. He set up a blue ribbon panel to look at the issue. Just yesterday, it held its first hearing, and I had a chance to speak with him.
How do you feel being the campaign chair for George Bush, who has presided over more executions than any governor in history of the U.S.?
I want to tell you something. Each governor has got to be comfortable with what they do in their own state. Probably one of the toughest jobs about being governor is that you have to make that decision about who's going to live or die. And you have to be comfortable, and you have to make sure that your system works. My system didn't work. I can't tell you about Texas. George Bush evidently is very comfortable with his position there, as he should be, and feels that the courts have given every opportunity to these defendants. And he's even, I think, given some time now for some DNA testing. So each governor has to do their own thing, and I don't criticize any governor for what they do.
And yet he's presided over more executions than any governor in the history of the United States. What about your stance on Cuba? You've taken a very interesting position. You actually went to Cuba. Why?
Yes. Well, we took a humanitarian group down there and they donated some medical supplies and the things that they needed, but because I think Cuba ought to be opened up for trade, frankly, and I think it would help free the Cuban people, it would be good for the Cuban people, and it would certainly be good for those of us in Illinois that got a lot of things we'd like to sell them.
Like what?
Oh, well, we got the Caterpillar, John Deere. We got a lot of farm products. We got pharmaceuticals. We got a lot of things that we could sell Cuba that they need very bad.
Do you think that the embargo should end?
I think the embargo should end. We're the only country in the world that's not doing business with Cuba.
And yet, has George W. Bush recommended this? He's still...
Well, I haven't really talked to him about it, frankly. I don't know. I think that there has been some movement, as you know. The Congress okayed the lifting the embargo on food and drug. So that's a start.
Back on the death penalty, you've now set up this Blue Ribbon Commission. Where do you go from here?
Well, today was their first meeting, and I haven't had a chance to get a report on what they did. But they had public hearings today. I understand over 40 people showed up to testify. And I just haven't had a chance to get a report on it.
Would you like to see the death penalty overturned in this country?
Well, look, I'm a proponent of the death penalty. I think there's probably times when it ought to be used. But you have to make sure that it's right and it's perfect. You can't take a chance of executing an innocent person. And I think that's what we're all concerned about, certainly what I was concerned about.
Are you concerned about the studies that show that the court system is racially discriminatory?
Sure. That was part of the reason that we went into this thing with this moratorium. We had, I think, 33 prisoners that had been convicted, African-Americans, that had been convicted by all-white juries. We've had... I don't remember the number, but I think well over 30 that were convicted and sent to death row when they were represented by attorneys that had been either disbarred or suspended from the practice of law or showed up in the courtroom drunk or fell asleep. Now, that just shouldn't happen, and those are things that can be fixed, and that's what we're trying to do.
So why is it you think that so many Republican delegates are so pro-death penalty, do not have the same observations that you do?
I don't know. Did you survey the delegates? You know that to be a fact?
I think the survey showed that the delegates to the convention are far more conservative than mainstream Republicans in the United States.
Yeah, well, that's probably true. I can't answer that. I would guess most of them haven't had to go through the decision of whether they want to execute somebody or not.
Have you had a conversation with George Bush about the death penalty?
No.
He presided over one of the more controversial ones on June 22nd, Gary Graham, Shaka right. Sankofa, where he had appeals from all over the United States and the world not to execute him, to put off that execution, yet he moved forward.
Well, he felt, from what I understand, that they had all of the access to the courts. What was he on death row for 20-some years? 18 years? 20 years? I don't remember. But he was guilty and found guilty, and he did what he thought was right, I'm sure.
Did you raise the death penalty at the Republican Governor's Convention?
No.
Do you feel it's an issue that Republicans should take on?
No, as I said, I think it's an issue for each governor to make his own mind up and decide what they have to do. If they want to change their laws in their state, they should do that. The ultimate obligation falls on the governor, and they have to be comfortable with the decision that they make.
The studies of the delegates here at the convention, more than 2,000 delegates, I believe more than 83% of them white, 4% African-American, 3% Latino. What's the problem here?
Well, I think that the Republicans have reached out and will continue to reach out to bring more minorities into the party. I think this convention, they tried to do that, and then the leadership of George Bush, they'll do that as he campaigns and works this country. You'll probably see more attempts to do that, and I think they'll be successful. I think he's got the right message for them.
And your view of Dick Cheney, who spoke tonight?
I thought it was the right pick for George Bush to make. I think he's the right man for the international experience, the foreign experience that he's got, and the experience he's got in Washington, D.C. I think he's a good match for George Bush.
And finally, your comment on the cynicism around these conventions, the Republican and the Democratic, that we're talking about. Huge sums of money poured into these conventions that make everyday Americans feel like this has nothing to do with them or democracy.
Well, that's unfortunate because this system is what we do to elect the most powerful person in the world, the President of the United States. And the Democrats will go through the same process in a couple of weeks, maybe in a little different fashion, but it'll be the same process. And I think it's up to the media, frankly, to do their best. To showcase each one of these conventions, to let the American public see their candidates and know who they are, know what they stand for, and it's going to take some money. It takes money to do those things.
What about 2/3 of the $130 million in soft money raised by the Republicans, raised by some minute fraction, something like 700 donors to the Republican Party?
You got me at a disadvantage because I don't know all about all those numbers.
small number of large money donors to the Republican Party, people feeling like the party is just bought and paid for?
Well, you know, I'm not going to comment on all those things. Those are issues that you folks like to talk about.
Do you think they're worthwhile issues?
Well, I think it costs far too much money to run for public office. I don't think there's any question about it at any level. It costs too much. But television is expensive, and radio and the newspaper ads are expensive.
Would you support campaign finance reform?
Here's what I think ought to be done. If you want to give me $1 million, you ought to be able to do that. You ought to be able to give me $1 million or $10 million or whatever you want to give. As long as everybody knows who you are, what you do, what your connection is, and it's public knowledge. Everybody knows that. And if they want to criticize or condemn or not vote for me for taking that $10 million, then that's what the system's about. But the problem is that we talk about campaign finance reform and we talk about reform, we always end up with a lot of loopholes. And no matter what kind of reform you got, there's always loopholes. So it ought to be a very simple plan, kind of like the income tax. They ought to make it a lot simpler. So when somebody said, where did you get all that money? I can say, I got it from you. And this is how much I got, and this is what she does. And they can then make the decision.
Ralph Nader went on the convention floor tonight.
He was out there tonight.
What do you think of that?
Well, I think Ralph Nader is going to help George Bush, frankly, being on the ticket.
Why?
Because I think he's going to pull votes from Al Gore.
What do you think of his politics?
Of his what?
Politics. What do you think of his criticism of the two-party system? And do you think he should be included in the debate as a third-party candidate?
Yeah, sure. That's fine with me. I think everybody that's a candidate, as I said, I think they ought to showcase these folks. Thank you.
Illinois Governor George Ryan speaking inside the media tent at the Republican National Convention last night. When we return, a short dialogue between the conservative Republican governor and presidential candidate Ralph Nader. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, broadcasting live from Philadelphia. We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, broadcasting live from Philadelphia at the Independent Media Center on the fourth day of the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we bring you now the brief dialogue between the conservative Republican Illinois Governor George Ryan and Ralph Nader, after Ralph Nader made that unprecedented appearance on the floor of the Republican National Convention.
Great thing for the moratorium.
We had our first public hearing today in Chicago, and I haven't gotten a full report on it, but I guess we had 40 or some people came in and testified. It was the right thing to do.
Absolutely. And it's a perfect example of a governor responding to the evidence. This is the way you did.
Well, we almost put some people to death that were innocent.
Yeah, which is the worst crime the governor can do.
That's my worst night.
Yeah, exactly.
Ralph Nader, let me ask you something. Governor Ryan just said that you're going to be very good for George W. Bush because you're going to pull votes from Al Gore.
Well, I think you're going to see me pulling votes from George W. Bush and from non-voters and from Ross Perot voters. Actually, the polls show a pretty diverse sort of support. But that's not my concern. My concern is building a new progressive party that brings more people who don't vote into the system. And in 1996, 90 million people didn't vote.
I don't know. That there's no question that needs to be done, and maybe this will be what it takes.
But we're having trouble with the Democrats trying to keep us off the ballot in Illinois, though.
I can't do much about that.
So where do you guys differ exactly? You're both against, well, you are for a moratorium and the death penalty as you are. You're portrayed with Cuba, both of you. Where exactly do you differ?
Well, I'm a Republican.
Yes, and what does that mean?
That means he's not.
But he'd like to be, maybe.
Wait.
Are you going to go to the Democrat convention?
I don't think so.
Nader. Are you concerned about Ralph Nader pulling votes from George Bush?
He's going to get votes from a lot of people.
What do you think is most appealing about Ralph Nader?
Well, he's been on the scene. He's been a tireless advocate for consumers across America. He's got that reputation, and he works very hard at it.
Illinois Governor George Ryan and Ralph Nader speaking after the Republican National Convention last night, after Dick Cheney spoke and George W. Bush was nominated to be the Republican presidential nominee. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move in now to what has been happening in the streets over the last few days, with more than 380 people arrested. Juan, we've been out there and you've been talking with a lot of people.
Yes, Amy, and I think the amazing thing is, once again, as happened in Seattle, was there is a sharp difference between the coverage of the national corporate media and the local media. I think those who look through the Inquirer and the Daily News, the two local newspapers, a lot of the local TV stations, realize that they're paying much more attention to what is going on in the streets than the national media, which are basically giving it, as they did in Seattle, the minimum coverage of the opposition movements in the streets, whereas those the press that are here, even though they may be distorting a lot of the events, at least they understand that there's more significance to these events going on the street, because the disruption that's being created within their own city is of more concern to them. So I think that's one of the things I've noticed. The other is that there is, from what I've been able to see, significantly more support among ordinary Philadelphians to some of the protests that are going on. Part of it is because Philadelphia is overwhelmingly a Democratic city. I interviewed many people in the African-American community out at 41st and Haverford, with the 75 people who were arrested in the building before they even had moved out by police, before they had done anything that could be called a reason for arrest, and found quite a bit of support. I talked to one man, Gene O'Neill, who, interestingly enough, the place where they were in was being characterized as an abandoned warehouse. It was not. Actually, Mr. O'Neill, who's in his 60s, explained to me that that was a former trolley and bus barn of the predecessor company to the SEPTA, which is the Regional Transportation Authority. And in the 50s, African Americans protested and picketed that place because they were being excluded from jobs. And so that that building has a historical significance within the black community there. And he said basically he supported the protesters, and he thought that the Republicans needed to wake up to some of the issues that they were ignoring at the convention.
That building having been broken into by the police, and it was where many protesters were making puppets and had other material. It was what their Ministry of Propaganda. So you've been talking to people in the streets, but you've also been observing the police behavior, and also put in the context of local and national politics, where, for example, John Timoney comes from, what's happening with him, the police commissioner of Philadelphia, who himself got involved with a brawl.
Yes, well, Timoney has played a very high-profile role here, unusual among police officials in that he has been personally involved directly on the streets in almost all of the activities, riding his bicycle into most scenes. And I think most of the protesters aren't even aware it's the police commissioner riding around on his bike. Of course, he's doing that because not only is he a hands-on cop, but he is being followed by some national media and has aspirations of eventually moving on to police commissioner in New York. So he's
where he came from.
Right. So he's almost sort of building his own public relations campaign as he's going along. And I think that but realistically, and I'm sure we're going to get into this with some of the guests, I think as someone who was there in Chicago at the 1968 Democratic Convention and covered the Seattle situation, I've covered several protests at other conventions, Democratic and Republican, in the past, I think that we've got to put the events here in some kind of a historical framework as well. the degree to which the police abuse here compares to some of what's happened in the past. I know I spent many years here under Frank Rizzo, the former mayor and police commissioner, and if Rizzo was the police commissioner today, there would be a much different scene in Philadelphia right now. Rizzo was a guy who, as mayor, when he was running for re-election the second time, said on a 6 o'clock news press conference in City Hall, "If I get re-elected, I'm going to make Attila the Hun look like a faggot." This was the mayor of the city of Philadelphia. Another time when his police had beaten the black man senseless and broken their billy clubs over his head in the front of hundreds of people in Center City, Philadelphia, Rizzo was asked at a press conference, "What do you think about what your police did? They broke their billy clubs over this man's head," and Rizzo responded in a press conference, "They don't make billy clubs the way they used to." That was the kind of leadership. This is a somewhat different leadership. It still has a lot of brutality, but it seems to me it has not been as massive as it was in Seattle, or as it was certainly when Richard Daley in Chicago ordered police to shoot at demonstrators. And I remember bullets flying in Chicago at demonstrators, in addition to tear gas and everything else.
Well, they may not be bullets here, but there are fists flying and there are batons that are beating protesters. One example of that is of that brutality that we can see right before us with our next guest, who prefers to be called Bork. Bork, I saw you yesterday come into the Independent Media Center. You have a serious shiner on your right eye. Your arm is bruised, and, well, we can't see what's under your pants. But can you tell us what happened to you?
Yes. I was peaceably demonstrating 2 days ago, and I was taking a banner into the street, admittedly to commit civil disobedience in a peaceful way. I had a rather large banner. I had reinforced it with wire because it makes it less liable to tear when you have a cloth banner. And police got very upset when they attempted to cut my banner up.
What did it say?
It said, "Stop the Texas Killing Machine." They apparently didn't like the message being outside of a Free Mumia Abu Jamal rally. And when they attempted to cut it up and they could not get it to cut, the police officer became very angry. He started pulling on it. I had tucked it into the pocket of my pants to support it because it was a very heavy banner. And so when he pulled on it, he was pulling me off my feet. I said, "I can't get it out. I can't get it out." And he just pulled me off my feet. The two or three other cops ran up to help him. The next thing I know, they had pulled me completely down. They started dragging me, wrapping me in the banner, and dragging me and kicking me. I don't know if you can see it, but we actually have a boot print from, if you see, I had tucked, which is one of the demonstrators are trained to tuck if people are attacking your face. And you can, at one point, you could actually see the boot print between my arm and my face of where the foot was. There's a boot print on my thigh also, and several bruises in other places on my body I can't show you. It was very bad, and it was so bad that when they got me to the jail after they'd arrested me, but while referring to me as an it, get its arms, take, you know, put cuffs on it, which was sort of a Nazi thing to do, they had gotten me to the jail, and the person who had been driving the vehicle was so appalled at the way I looked, at the bleeding of my hands where my fingernails had been torn out while I was trying to stop them from dragging me so far, that he just said, "I'm going to take you to the hospital or back to the protest. Your arresting officer isn't here yet. You need to go to the hospital. Let me take you." And he took me. I thank that officer. Compared to the other officers, he was quite nice.
You said yesterday that he said, "I'm just too old for this."
Yeah, he said, "I'm just too old to deal with these young shits," referring to the other officers. Sorry.
So you went to the hospital, and you were not arrested because he brought you there.
Yes, I had been arrested. I was in cuffs. There was an arresting officer, but the officer who took me in the van was so appalled at the condition I was in, bleeding and whatnot, that he he decided on the spot to take me to the hospital instead.
Brian Petruska, you're a paralegal with the R2K Legal Collective. Is Bork's story a typical one this week, 380 people arrested?
I wouldn't say it's typical, but it's very common. We've had reports of a lot of very excessive police beating, both on Tuesday and then especially on Wednesday. Wednesday in particular was characterized by that the police violence was largely, well, almost entirely unprovoked. We have reports of, by almost all regards, very peaceful demonstrations in which the police took it upon themselves to enter into crowds and pick out certain individuals to enact violence on, and in many cases serious violence. We actually had a legal observer who are identifiable by hats, demonstrating that they are objective observers for legal purposes, and he was beaten so badly that he was sent to the hospital. We also actually had a report from Tuesday of a man who was beaten so badly that he had to have his ear stitched back to his head. And as a result, at arraignment, the judge was so appalled at how beaten he was that he gave him reduced bail because he didn't want him to go back to jail.
I've also heard about this strategy of just picking up people on the street who are walking along the street, not doing anything at the time. John Sellers, who is the head of Ruckus Society, well known for its training of people around the country in direct action, was just picked up on the street yesterday. What was he charged with?
At this point, R2K has no information on John Sellers. We only find out information when people call our legal hotline. And basically, we take care of all the observers as a whole, and if we do find out any information on him, we will treat him as with all the other observers because we are taking care of everyone, so we wouldn't go about singling people out for any particular role or position that they might have.
I had heard something about inciting to riot.
We actually anticipate that trumped-up charge will be leveled against many people. The police are actively looking for a leader in a leaderless movement, and they're going to keep projecting on their own presumptions of leadership onto people just to find it, because probably it's the only model they can understand.
I noticed in several instances downtown yesterday, police stopping people on bicycles and just searching them completely and demanding identification, and something that is clearly a violation of people's rights. Have you gotten many reports of those also?
We've had numerous reports of people who have been stopped either on the sidewalk but also in vehicles. They've been stopped with no traffic violations. One case, someone was stopped at a red light and the police surrounded the car, removed the individual from the car, and then proceeded to arrest him and impound his vehicle. And by witnesses who saw the account, there was utterly no illegal activity going on. Before that, the only the only indication of why this occurred was because the in the back of the truck there were protest signs.
Brian Petruska is a legal paralegal with R2K Legal Collective. Scott Kellogg is also with us. You were detained yesterday?
On Tuesday.
What happened?
We were preparing to leave the 41st and Haverford space where which had been raided that day, and just as we were leaving, our truck, which had been filled with puppets and signs and no lethal or dangerous materials, we were leaving the space and were blocked off by a police car and probably surrounded about 7 police cars. A second van was pulled over as well. We were not told why we were being pulled over, just told to make our hands visible, and at which point we were each removed from the truck and placed in a police van. Not ever arrested at any point, but not being told why we were being detained, other than that we were being subject to an investigation. And so we were placed in the van and held there for a number of hours, eventually being driven around for a total of 5 hours and then released without ever being arrested. They were attempting to. They were trying to take us into the space to process us, but we refused. And then we went back to the truck to reclaim it. They had detectives there who told us we would receive a warrant or a receipt of some sort, which we never did. They came 2 hours later and towed the truck away, and I have not received any information about where the truck is. I haven't been... never was shown a warrant, don't believe they even managed to acquire one, and no receipt for the truck or any of its contents. I've been told it will be searched and inventoried, and I don't know when, or I'll have to be given it back or anything inside of it.
Have you tried to go to the police headquarters to find out what happened with the truck? Or?
Yeah, I went to the police headquarters, mm-hmm. and they gave me the typical runaround. Mm-hmm. I went to the ACLU yesterday and have somebody there, hopefully working on the case, but I'll be here until I get it back.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us and end with Bork yesterday, you coming out of the hospital with your shiner and your bruises. Confronted delegates again, is that right?
Absolutely. They're not going to intimidate me. I intend to get my message across that the Republican Party has not been accountable to the people. They have spent $50 million on a party for themselves that could have been used to feed and house people. They advocate the death penalty. They're obviously lost their humanity. Just look at my face, you can tell.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, but also point out that you're talking about a Democratic administration that the police are operating under here in Philadelphia.
The Democrats and the Republicans are all one party.
Will you be in Los Angeles?
I'd like to be.
Well, we will be there, certainly, and we'll be broadcasting live from the Independent Media Center there at Patriotic Hall, which is right near the Staples Center, where the Democrats will be nominating their presidential and vice presidential candidates. We want to thank Brian Petrusko of R2K Legal, Scott Kellogg, Protester, and Bork. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! One of the issues that is very critical to Americans is health care and pharmaceuticals, and we're going to be joined by two people next to talk about the platform forms of the Republican and Democratic Party. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, and the sounds you hear in the background are the Independent Media Center, where hundreds of video and radio journalists have gathered, grassroots activists who have come here to chronicle what has been happening not only here, but in Seattle and Washington, D.C., with the World Bank IMF protests, and they're headed to the Democratic Convention as well in Los Angeles. We are in the midst of an unprecedented Democratic media collaborative. We are broadcasting on community radio around the country, on community television, that's public access stations around the country, and we are on the Dish Network, channel 9415, which is Free Speech TV's new 24-hour network. Free Speech TV, based in Boulder, Colorado, we're working with them and Deep Dish in this national collaborative that has never been tried before. You can also watch us on our website. We are video streaming as well as audio streaming, and have a special website for the conventions and the entire election season. It is called Breaking with Convention: Power, Protest, and the Presidency. You can do everything from looking at the number of people that George Bush has had killed on death row in Texas to researching how much money your Congress member or city council member is getting, where it is coming from. You can do it yourself on our website. And you can email us during the program. We'll be reading those emails from people around the world. You can email us at democracy@pacifica.org. Our website, again,
and democracynow.org as we move into our last segment of this hour, and that is the issue of health care. Juan?
Well, Amy, recent surveys have shown that on average seniors are being charged retail prices that are double the prices charged by prescription drug makers to their most favored customers, such as the Department of Defense and Veterans Affairs. And when it comes to the stances of the parties on the prescription drug industry, it seems as if campaign cash and connections from the major drug companies will block any push for comprehensive Medicare coverage. This comes at a time when 45 million people don't have health care and 90 million don't have prescription drug coverage. So we're going to deal with some of these issues today with Pedro Rodriguez, with the Action Alliance, the largest senior citizens association in Philadelphia first. Pedro,
how you doing?
Welcome. What do you see in terms of both the platforms of the Republicans and the Democrats, but we're here at the Republican convention, in terms of dealing with this immense crisis of prescription drugs for seniors?
Well, in terms of speaking of the Republicans' pronouncements on this issue, it's total hypocrisy. Total hypocrisy, very raw hypocrisy, trying to appeal to the senses of senior citizens across the land in this very severe crisis that we're facing today in the United States. The fact of the matter is that the Republican-controlled Congress had the opportunity to resolve this issue on a number of occasions, and they have failed to do so. They have failed miserably to do so. And they are curtailing to the will of the pharmaceutical industry, which is now spending $30 million on a campaign, television and print campaign, to mislead the American people on this particular issue. So we're not surprised to see what's emerging out of the FU Center here in Philadelphia from the Republican National Convention. What we are encouraged is that, for what we can see, a lot of the seniors will keep pressing on to resolve this issue. There are two main ways to resolve this issue right now. And if the Republicans wanted to do so, they could do so. One is to expand Medicare and add a Part D that will create a universal, voluntary prescription drug coverage that will really make prescription coverage as part of Medicare. Medicare is a great health program, but it's obsolete in the sense that it doesn't have prescription drug coverage. And the second thing that they can do, if they have the will to do it, is put a stop to the skyrocketing prices that the pharmaceuticals continue to charge unabated in this country. It is inconceivable that the same drug manufactured in the United States in the same package with the same labeling is sold 60% less in Canada or in Mexico. That is inconceivable.
Dr. Joel Chinitz is with us also. He's a member of the Philadelphia Physicians for Social Responsibility and the medical director of the Physician Assistant Program at Philadelphia University.
That's correct.
Now, can you tell us, I know that in the southern parts of the United States along the border, many people travel into Mexico to buy prescription drugs, the same thing in people going into Canada. How is this possible that this can continue to function, as Pedro was saying, the same drugs being so markedly cheaper in other countries?
Well, I certainly agree with everything that Pedro has said, and I agree that the prices are clearly much higher. In fact, they've gone up by 85% from 93 to 98. One only needs to pick up the newspaper and see a double spread advertisement for one of the high-priced drugs that are being marketed extensively. One only needs to go to a medical setting to see the kinds of the kinds of perks that are given to physicians, or in some cases where I've gone to get medications to give to patients in the homeless clinic, and I've gone to some of my friends in private practice, and we've opened up their drug sample cabinet, and there are thousands and thousands.
What are those perks?
Well, the perks can range from anything to a free pen, to a free trip, to attending a conference, and attending a conference, being transported 3,000 miles, being hosted, wined, and dined, and doing that. And that's the extreme, and that's clearly for those who use larger amounts of the medication. Now, overall, I don't think that's the major part of the problem. I certainly can't speak with any background or insight into the pharmaceutical industry. But I'm part of what's called the Ad Hoc Committee to Defend Healthcare. And what we're seeing is whatever the Republicans are offering or whatever the Democrats are offering are really just tinkering on around the edges of a healthcare system which really needs to be built. We need a healthcare system, and that's lacking at the moment. And I think the pharmaceutical component of that is only one fraction.
What are the other aspects of it?
Well, the other aspects you've already mentioned, there are 45 million people, 44.3 at this count, without any health care coverage at all, many with lesser, with limited coverage, and the number is going up by 1 million a year. Every time that there are some efforts made to control the quality with patients' Bill of Rights, that increases the cost, that decreases the ability for people to get coverage. So it's a self-defeating kind of thing. The other thing is there's significant profit making through the whole healthcare system, not just the pharmaceuticals. So that's a great concern. When you have profit making organizations in healthcare, the administrative, Pedro said Medicare is efficiently run. It's got a 3% overhead. These operations have a 25% overhead. What these private organizations call the money that they're actually spending for healthcare is called a medical loss. So I think that gives you some concept of what's happening there. The other part of the problem is that for many millions of people, healthcare is linked to employment. And therefore, while they're trying to develop this market-based system of having something applicable to the consumer is not actually the one who's buying the product. It's being bought by their employer, who obviously is interested primarily in the cost. And therefore, the available care goes down. What the individual is doing is paying more of their own money out of pocket for their own insurance.
We're talking to two people who specialize in the issue of healthcare, seniors and the pharmaceutical industry. Dr. Joel Chinitz, member of the Philadelphia Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Pedro Rodriguez with the Action Alliance, the largest senior citizens association in Philadelphia, here in the city of the first convention and this year's Republican convention. So you've described what the problems are. What are exactly the Republicans proposing, and what are your problems with that?
There are a number of problems when it comes to the Republicans dealing with the senior population in this country. One, that they are, of course, relying on the private market to resolve the issue of health care for senior citizens. The House of Representatives just a month ago try to deal with the issue of prescription drug coverage, and they pass a bill which voucherizes the solution to this problem. Giving the solution to the HMOs to handle it, it's really a miserable attempt to resolve this issue. One, because Medicare HMOs are dumping seniors all over the United States. They say they're not making enough money. They want to make more money. So why would you turn over a new program to an industry that is, really doesn't want to deal with that? That's the Republicans' solution to that end. On the other hand, they had totally refused to deal in the House with the whole issue of prescription drug prices, what to do about putting a stop to the runaway prices that the pharmaceuticals keep charging seniors and the American people in this country. They're not dealing with that issue. They're failing to deal with that issue. And that's an issue they will not address. To them, addressing that issue is smacks of socialized medicine or price control. Actually, at Action Alliance, we don't have trouble with either of those terms. I mean, a lot of our members went through price controls during World War II, and they it worked then. So if it has to be price controls on pharmaceuticals, so be it.
Dr. Joel Chinitz, a few years ago, you never saw advertisements on television telling people, talk to your doctor about this drug. All of a sudden now, in the last few years, virtually every night on TV, for everything from Viagra to any kind of new drug, suddenly there's enormous advertising. This, of course, is an expense that these companies, the marketing expenses for these companies, and then these are put into the actual price of the drugs. How did this just develop all of a sudden in the last few years?
Well, again, I'm not an expert on legislation, but I think this was something that was legislated. In other words, it became, and I guess, Pedro, you may know better than I think in 97 was then legislated that they could advertise directly to the consumer. So you're seeing it in the newspapers, and you're seeing it on the buses, and you're seeing it on the television, and hearing about it in the radio. And they're creating a market. They're creating.
But what does that do to the doctor now, who now has a patient coming in who wants, because they've seen the advertisement on television, they want to tell the doctor what drug they need?
Okay. So what you're saying, in essence, is that as more and more pressure is put on the physician to see more and more patients, and what had been the 20-minute visit and then the 15-minute visit is now the 8-minute visit, soon it'll be the 6-minute visit, within that 6-minute period of time, the amount that's to be accomplished in that encounter has grown. Efforts to provide preventive care are recognized as very, very important, and yet a patient without a significant knowledge and background who has been marketed for this particular product is going to want to have that kind of discussion. So clearly it changes the balance of things, and I personally don't think that's the place to present medical needs.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with
us.
Dr. Joel Chinitz of the Philadelphia Physicians for Social Responsibility, Pedro Rodriguez with the Action Alliance, the largest senior citizens association in Philadelphia. How can people get in touch with you?
They can call our office. That's at 215-557-0751, and we're located at 1201 Chestnut Street in Philadelphia.
And Dr. Joel Chinitz.
Well, let me say, for the moment, if people want to join the ad hoc committee, suggest they call Philadelphia Physicians for Social Responsibility at 215-765-8703.
And those numbers, as well as all contacts and websites, are on our website at democracynow.org. And you can also listen to the program again if you missed any part of it, and tell friends who don't hear Democracy Now, either on their public access station, on their community radio station, that they can get us by simply calling those stations. That does it for today's program.
If it's left me or found a new place to dwell, way down at the end of Medicare Street, it's Healthcare Hotel. Insurance only, baby. Insurance only. Insurance only, or you'll die. Although it's always crowded, you still can get in line.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, which is broadcast from the floor of the Independent Media Center in Philadelphia during this Republican National Convention. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. We've had help from Deepa Fernandez, Tia Lesson, and John Hamilton. Our technical director is Grayson Challenger. More assistance from Sanaz Mosfarian, David Thompson, Lisa Shawl, Nell Geiser. Video production is by Dee Dee Halleck, Skip Blumberg, Linda Iannacone, Carlos Perea, Jay Pennington, Ben Thomas, Pete St. Marie, Jessica Glass. Internet production by Prothap Chatterjee, Lena Hoshino, and Derek Chung. Thanks to Paper Tiger Television, Changing America, Deep Dish TV, and the Independent Media Center in Philadelphia. Special thanks to Dee Dee Halleck as well. Well, if you'd like to order a cassette of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Again in this unprecedented collaboration with Free Speech TV, broadcasting on public access stations and community radio stations. If you want to tell your friends how to pick us up on community radio stations, all they need to do is call their local public radio station and say Democracy Now! Is what they want to hear. We're also live streaming and archived on the web. Thanks for listening. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez from Philadelphia.